Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, a Route 66 icon will continue standing along the Mother Road in Illinois, as it has for decades. We'll explain the past and the future of the Gemini Giant. Killers of the Flower Moon was a best-selling book. It's now a major motion picture. We'll visit the community that was at the center of it all. A college professor and filmmaker has a new documentary that examines how music reflects the world around it, nowhere more so than the Mississippi Delta. He talks about the Delta Blues. We'll also talk with a resume expert about age bias for older Americans seeking work and some tips on how to make sure you're judged on your qualifications. And we'll look back at how some experienced the solar eclipse. Most were on the ground, but not everyone. Those stories and more coming up this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A big story this week was up above us, the solar eclipse. Thousands of people poured into towns, stadiums, and fields in the path of totality. It lasted about 4 minutes, but it left an emotional impression on many watching, and our reporters captured these sounds.
I'm Brian Munoz in Carbondale, Illinois. Thousands of people pack into Southern Illinois University's Lukey Stadium to watch the total solar eclipse. It will be the last one in the region for over 300 years. Best of all, the sky is clear. Sarah Maxwell is here from Kansas City with her telescope. She tried to watch the eclipse in 2017, but the clouds got in the way.
I'm going to cry a million happy tears. I just want to see this so bad, so it's going to be a very happy, emotional experience.
7 years ago, clouds blocked the view here in Saluki Stadium, too. Today, the crowds cheer as the moon slips in front of the sun in full view. Nina Seidler-Wagner stands on the roof of the press box next to her mother. She made the trek all the way from Colgate, Wisconsin.
Amazing. No words. If somebody hasn't experienced it, they don't know what they're missing out on. Oh, so gorgeous.
This is Kate Grumke at the Bollinger Mill State Historic Site. It's about 20 miles west of Cape Girardeau, and the eclipse has just started. Here in southeast Missouri, scientists from Washington University have set up a tailgating tent with computers attached to telescopes and cameras. But they're not just here to study the eclipse. They're mostly here to answer questions, like this one from 10-year-old Maxwell LaGrasso.
Why can't you look at the solar eclipse without glasses?
Maxwell is a self-described science geek and aspiring future astronaut. He and his grandparents made the trip from Waukon, Iowa.
How does the moon orbit, the dark side of the moon specifically, orbit right over the sun?
Okay, so there's no dark side of the moon, actually.
Answering Maxwell's questions is Mike Krasinski, an associate professor at WashU who studies planetary formation and evolution.
It's so exciting to be able to show the science to everyone here, because everyone is here because they want to be. They want to learn.
Outside of the tent, the air is getting cooler. About 1,500 people are spread out on picnic blankets and lawn chairs in a field. As the moon covers the sun, the crowd cheers. Maxwell is watching with his grandparents.
I'm like, oh my God. Like when I couldn't see it in my glasses, I was like, oh my God, what happened? I take off my glasses and I'm like, oh my God, that's so cool.
I'm Sarah Fenton in Chester, Illinois. This small town's known mostly for being the birthplace of E.C. Seeger, who created the Popeye cartoon.
I am what I am, and that's all what I am.
There's even a mini Popeye museum and shop here. It's the perfect place for Ryan Maxwell, a Popeye superfan from Indiana, to watch the eclipse.
And I've got my Popeye-branded eclipse glasses.
By lunch, there's a steady stream of cars heading into town. Hundreds of people gather at a hilly park on the south side. St. Louis College students Devin Kriegler and Jalen Bogard sit watching the sky dim.
It looks like if you took a low exposure photo or a video of everyone.
It's also getting chillier and chillier by the second. Starting to feel the wind and everything, so it's also really cool.
And then finally...
Where is
it? It's not even...
What?
Oh my God!
Glasses off,
maybe? Glasses off?
Yes, take it off.
Look around, look around. Take it off.
Oh my God.
Wait, hold on.
Their friend Azaria Covington says this trip is special.
We all just like came together and decided to come and appreciate, you know, the wonderful universe that we live in, which is really cool. So I really liked experiencing it with people that I care about. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That was cute.
That report from Sarah Fintum, Kate Grumke, and Brian Munoz. Also, Reginald Hardwick produced an audio postcard from Fort Defiance, the most southern part of Illinois where the Mississippi and Ohio rivers merge.
We're about 4 minutes away from totality, and it looks like a shadow has just been cast over us. Hundreds of people here lying on blankets, some have telescopes, they have families, and they all have their glasses, and we're all looking up. What does it feel like?
I cannot describe it with words. It is the first time I see an astronomical event of this magnitude. For me, it's some sort of a connection between the human being and the universe. You know, it's very spiritual from my standpoint.
I've never experienced anything like this either.
I'm very excited. My heart is shaking. It's something that I would never regret have done. It is very dark. It is like dawn or dusk, probably. It looks more like a day in the morning when you're waking up and it starts to getting clear, you know? It is.
The bridge lights are on.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, because they have this kind of light sensor. It probably detected that it was dark and turned on. Wow.
Absolutely amazing. So gorgeous.
So beautiful. It almost looked like there was a solar flare or something at the bottom.
I know. I don't know what was at the bottom. It was like a little, like,
it was beautiful.
We're questioning a solar flare, but we don't know. Yeah. Yeah.
It was great. It was great. It was better than 2017, actually.
Why do you say that?
Well, because to me, I could see the corona a lot better on this one than I could in 2017. So, and it was about a minute longer than I had last time. So it was wonderful.
What did you think when it was totally dark?
It was great. Yeah. Yeah, you don't want to, I didn't want to mess with the camera or the scope. I just wanted to look at it, you know, and just soak it in.
What will you remember about this experience?
Besides totality, it's just meeting all the people here, you know, in the community and everybody. So that was the best part, yeah.
You heard from nature photographer Uriel Soberanez, Michael Matheny, and Kelly Sopko, who drove from Tennessee to Fort Defiance outside of Cairo to watch the total eclipse. The last voice in that postcard from Bill Meffert, a retired engineer. He drove more than 6 hours from Georgia for the cosmic event. And while most of us were earthbound watchers, others found a different view, above the clouds, on board a plane. Jeremy Goodwin had a seat on one of the flights.
At Lambert International Airport's gate E14 Monday around noon, the mood's a lot more festive than usual. There's balloons, cookies, star and moon decorations, and Southwest Airline employees like Ivy Goodlow wearing black t-shirts with the date and the words, "I got mooned."
We have hula hoops and we have jump ropes, and if you stay there the longest doing this hula hoop, then you get a blue ribbon. And we have a person that's probably going to be the winner. She's going. All right. Good job.
That gets a blue ribbon.
That is a blue ribbon.
About 150 paying customers crowd the gate, plus a handful of journalists, including me, who Southwest gave a free ride to document the occasion. We're all waiting for a flight to Houston. It's one of three the airline identified as offering the best chance to see the total eclipse. Many travelers here are in the midst of some very long days. A lot of them flew to St. Louis to catch this flight.
We had to take a flight from Albuquerque to Denver
from Denver to St. Louis, St. Louis to Houston, and then Houston to Phoenix, and then Phoenix back to Albuquerque.
That's Tristan Martinez. Her 14-year-old son, Nico Martinez, is a budding astronomical photographer. He wants to make up for a mishap that happened before the total eclipse in 2017.
I was in New Mexico, and I was like seven, and they stole my solar eclipse glasses at school.
Oh, no. Yeah.
This time he's prepared with a snazzy digital telescope that takes photos.
It'll be able to take long exposures. I can take a time lapse of the eclipse, and I can take pictures of the sun's corona.
Other passengers are less scientifically minded, but know they want a dramatic view. Babette Lewis flew here from Minneapolis to take this flight.
I just started reading about it and seeing photos that other people have taken from previous eclipses from airplanes, and I thought, that's something I wanted to do.
Super cool.
We were told to expect the view of totality pretty early on in the flight. And on board the plane, the captain makes announcements to let us know we're getting really close.
We're pretty much in the middle of the zone of totality.
So looking down, it's like it's a dark, almost could be a dark haze. Can't see the ground. People now crowding over to the left side. Wow, it is dark out the window. The sun is nearly straight above us, and it isn't easy to see it from the cabin. The pilot banks sharply to each side, giving folks on the left and right sides of the plane chances to crane their necks and try to catch a glimpse. The man next to me is crouching partially on the floor, twisted nearly upside down to get the right angle. When it's my turn, I lie across the seats on my back and peer up.
Oh my goodness.
I see, that is a total eclipse of the sun right there. The corona, I can see it, there you go.
Oh wow, there it comes. Just coming back now, that's it.
That was short, but we got it.
We saw it. Nico Martinez is a row behind with his digital telescope. He didn't get the great time-lapse photo he wanted, but he's excited to compare notes with
Did you see it in totality?
I did, I saw it.
You saw the sun? Did you see the solar flares? The two little red dots on the side?
I did not see red dots. I think I might have seen...
For the rest of the flight, folks chat and share photos while the eclipse buzz lingers in the air. As we walk off the plane, airline employees at the gate give us an ovation. It's one last surreal twist on an unusual journey. At William P. Hobby Airport in Houston, I'm Jeremy Goodwin.
According to the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, the next total solar eclipse visible in the U.S. will happen in August of 2044. You're listening to Statewide. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced it will pump millions of dollars to track deaths from sudden cardiac arrest. It's part of the American Heart Association's goal to reduce the sudden deaths by 2030. Meanwhile, some existing heart screenings can detect issues and potentially prevent future complications, including death. But medical experts have debated the value of mandating these tests for decades. Side Effects Public Media's Elizabeth Gabriel reports.
Teresa Mako describes her son Zach as an honor student, a caretaker for his family, and a fierce basketball player. Zach got heart screenings after his doctor thought he heard a heart murmur. The test said he was fine. Years later, the mother and son heard about a teenager dying from sudden cardiac arrest, but they thought Zach was in the clear.
And ironically, he and I talked about it, and we're like, so glad we don't have to worry about that with you because you had a heart screening.
Ultrasounds and electrocardiograms can capture heart conditions much better than a physical exam, but the EKG is only a snippet in time. It doesn't account for when people go in and out of irregular heart rhythms, and they can incorrectly diagnose people. Some medical professionals recommend kids get screened annually after detecting a potential heart abnormality, but Teresa says Zach's cardiologist didn't tell them that. Exactly a week before his 18th birthday, Zach's heart stopped pumping blood. He went into cardiac arrest in 2018 due to an enlarged heart. His mom thinks his death could have been prevented.
Had he had a screening 2 years later, we might have seen something, and then maybe even screened again 2 years later, we definitely would have caught that.
For kids, a sudden cardiac arrest is deadly 9 out of 10 times. Half of the people who die from it don't show symptoms. Still, the American Heart Association doesn't recommend mandating heart screenings. They suggest giving a doctor your family history, have them listen to the heart with a stethoscope, and complete a physical. But medical professionals like cardiologist Preetham Jetty say that may not be enough for everyone.
Can a history and physical exam find everyone who's going to have a cardiac event? The answer is no. You will miss some. And that's where EKGs and ultrasounds can add some value.
That's why Mago and many other parents across the country now host heart screenings after losing a child to sudden cardiac arrest.
This is a natural human reaction to want to do something to make your child's death more meaningful.
That's Ben Levine, a cardiologist at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. While he understands the rationale, he says more heart screenings are not the answer.
They want to help, but they don't necessarily understand or think through all the downstream consequences.
EKGs can incorrectly diagnose heart problems in as many as a quarter of patients. That can lead to families spending thousands of dollars in unnecessary medical bills and unneeded surgeries.
The problem is, A, our screening is not perfect. B, it causes a lot of problems and may, in certain cases, hurt people rather than help them. And the majority of people who are going to die or have a cardiac arrest are those who had normal screening to begin with.
These opinions reflect the larger heart screening debate worldwide. Research in Italy suggested that mandating heart screenings for all athletes was behind a significant decrease in sudden cardiac arrest deaths. But studies in other countries did not give similar results, and the Italian team was accused of refusing to share their data for an independent review. Levine says the question of whether EKGs save lives could be answered through a randomized controlled trial, but there hasn't been a big enough study and the data is spotty.
It's almost impossible to track outcomes in the United States. That's what makes it so difficult to study. There's no mandatory reporting system for sudden cardiac arrest.
One thing the medical community agrees on is that training people on how to do CPR and preparing schools with automated external defibrillators, or AEDs, and an emergency plan can save lives. Elizabeth Gabriel, Side Effects Public Media.
A Route 66 icon will stay at home. We'll have that story in just a moment on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The city of Wilmington in Will County has been home to one of the most iconic attractions along Route 66, and a recent effort makes sure it will continue to be. Known as the Gemini Giant, the 20-foot-tall statue of an astronaut dressed in a green suit has overlooked Route 53 for decades. It recently went up for auction. That could have meant the giant would leave his post for good. Instead, a local group jumped in and won the bidding. The giant was taken down and now is being refurbished. It will soon be back in the same town. We get more on the story from Sasha Ann Simons, who spoke with architecture sleuth Dennis Rodkin.
This is quite the story. I loved reading your article. It's quite the picture of, you know, multiple people and organizations just kind of working together to save the Gemini Giant.
The Gemini Giant, yeah, because there's sort of a nostalgic and hometown feeling that it really belonged there. The Gemini Giant, as you said, is 20 feet tall.
Yeah.
500 wearing a green pounds. Suit. Yeah, and wearing a helmet. Maybe the only one of this genre wearing a helmet. He's one of what's either called giants, American giants, or muffler men, depending on which sort of population you're in.
Okay.
So they were these fiberglass advertising figures created in Venice, California in the 1960s and 70s. And they stood all over the country. And we'll talk about how there are still some in the Chicago area.
Yeah.
This one may be the only one who was wearing a helmet and was the most famous one dressed as an astronaut. You see Native Americans. You see cowboys. You see women in bikinis. That's another version.
Really?
Made by the same company. This was an astronaut.
Yeah. As you said, he's one of several of these human giant sculptures that are kind of plotted around the country. Some are even Hollywood famous, Dennis.
Yeah. Well, so there was one in Easy Rider in the 60s. Uh-huh. There's one in Wayne's World.
I remember that one.
Yeah, and it's in that famous Bohemian Rhapsody stretch of Wayne's World.
Also, there's nothing I don't remember from the 90s.
There's
there's that too.
And then coming into the 2000s, there are two in the credits for Parks and Recreation. One of those is in Indiana, and I couldn't figure out where the other one is.
Oh, but the Amy Poehler show.
Yeah, the Amy Poehler. Yeah, yes. There are two. Right at the beginning of the credits, you see two of these giants. So they're these... they're these retro figures that people just have a great affection for.
Okay, they're a big deal. So let's go back to Wilmington then. Take us to that moment when the Gemini Giant actually needed saving because it stood in the same spot for decades. So what changed?
Well, the restaurant closed. It was in front of a restaurant that most recently was called the Launching Pad, having to do with the astronaut. The restaurant closed. It was for sale. There were attempts to buy both the restaurant and the Giant. And then eventually... in late 2023, the former owner of the property put the Giant and a lot of the restaurant fixtures up for auction.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question was, is this Giant going to be removed from this site next to Route 66 where he has stood since the mid-60s, probably 1965?
Yeah.
Is he going to be removed? Are people going to buy him to take him somewhere else? So that was sort of a... scary prospect in Wilmington and the area around it.
Right, right. And so there's a GoFundMe effort that surfaced that kind of took off, but then looks like it fell short of the actual goal. Who started this?
This is so interesting. It's a man named Ryan Jindura. He got a lot of publicity in sort of February and early March trying to raise money for saving the Gemini Giant. And I spoke with him in advance of this segment when we were getting ready to do it. And he had a $100,000 goal and he had come up with about $27,000.
Okay.
But it looked like there might be more. And he was headed into this auction and nobody really knew how it was going to end.
Mm-hmm.
He had not accomplished his goal. There were other bidders apparently hovering around at the edges. And then there's a surprise finish to the auction.
Yeah, but before we get to the surprise finish, I mean, you mentioned that sort of cliffhanger that happened there where people don't know what's going to happen with this statue. Now, is it under threat of leaving not just Wilmington, but Illinois? Like, could it just leave the state?
Could well have. I mean, it depends on where the buyer is.
I see.
And so the auction house was in Minnesota and had their expertise is auctioning restaurant equipment. So they really had no idea what's going to happen with this giant. But yes, it could well have left Illinois.
Yeah. So this big finish, tell us about it.
Well, there was a dark horse. It's fascinating. I'm talking to people before the auction, and I never hear about this. And then when the auction concludes, it turns out that the Joliet Area Historical Museum, Joliet being right next to Wilmington, had a tourism grant from the state of Illinois and bid against others to become the final winner at $275,000.
Oh, my goodness. All right. So, Dennis, let's get back to the story here. Do we know how many bidders wanted to purchase the statue?
Well, so I spoke to the auction company in Minnesota, and they weren't able to give me some details because of the nature of the auction. They said there were over 300 bidders on that lot, which would be the statue as well as the restaurant fitting. So I don't know how many were bidding on the Gemini Giant itself.
Yeah.
But we do know that the bidding was fast and furious and rose very quickly to over $200,000. And
over $200,000.
Yeah. And so what's interesting is I sent you a clip of there's an old CBS News segment on these giants from last fall.
Yes.
And the reporter for CBS said these often sell for the tens of thousands of dollars. And so now we've got one in Illinois that sold for hundreds.
Yeah, that reporter was way off. we care more about our statues.
We apparently do, and partly because we have a lot of them. So it turns out that what happened was the Joliet Area Historical Museum had this grant. They had previously tried to buy the whole property. That had fallen through.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a grant, a tourism grant from the state, and they decide they're going to go ahead and bid on the statue itself. But what the director of the museum told me is they kind of kept it quiet because they didn't want to get in the way of other people's attempts to buy the statue, like Ryan Jindura's and others. And they also, you know, didn't want to drive the bidding up. Fat lot of good that did them because the bidding rose so fast. It turns out that it gets to $200,000 and then $225,000 and then $250,000. And the other bidders, there were at least two other bidders still in the game after $200,000. The bid comes in from the Joliet Museum at $275,
right,
and everybody else drops out. So then they're the winners.
Oh, my goodness. Well, speaking of happening fast, the removal of the Gemini Giant. I mean, the group, you write in your piece, they didn't waste any time taking it down.
They basically pulled up in a truck and took it away right then. It's really interesting. So again, they're keeping it quiet, but they're gathering this coalition.
Yeah.
By this time, they've got Ryan Jinder involved with them, but the museum, preservationists, some of these specialists in muffler men or American giants, they've all quietly gotten together and are planning to pull right in and take the giant right away. They apparently had sort of a credible threat that somebody was going to destroy the sculpture.
I see, because my next question was going to be, what's the rush?
Nobody's speaking openly about what was going on, but they said we had reason to believe that we had to get it out of there right away.
Yeah.
So they pull up in a truck whose flatbed has a specially built frame.
Mm-hmm.
They have a crane. They cut the Gemini giant off at his feet. They lift him up. I think you've seen the pictures.
What a sight. Yes.
Yeah. We've got them on the website. They lift him up by crane. So it's the first time the Gemini giant has actually gone into space, right? And then they lay him down,
Dennis,
on the truck and they drive away. Police escort. Crowds all around, and they drive the Gemini giant away.
Oh, my goodness. And so I asked the big question earlier, Dennis, where's that statue?
Well,
does it have a new home?
It does have a new home coming. It's going to be restored at a museum in Atlanta, Illinois, which is a museum of American giants.
Okay.
There are a couple of others. One was moved down from the city, and they're having a big opening on Memorial Day.
Okay.
So road trip.
Yes.
But they're going to restore it, and then it's going to come back. It's going to end up less than a mile from where it was in Wilmington and be sort of the focal point of a Route 66 memorial. Route 66, that famous old highway from Chicago to Los Angeles, is celebrating its centennial in 2026. So the idea is that the giant will be back in place well ahead of that to sort of be the linchpin of celebrations of Route 66 in Illinois.
It's perfect timing then for these statue shenanigans, if you will, Dennis. Because, there's a group of preservationists, I'm not sure if you're aware, they're actually looking to keep the memories of Route 66 alive. And they're asking folks to just submit any personal stories you have, whether it's stuff that we've heard before or untold stories of that highway, and do it before the centennial in 2020. But I wonder if you think there are going to be some Gemini giant stories as part of that bunch submitted.
I would assume when you start looking for people's history with the Gemini giant, everybody talks about going there for lunch when they were kids and posing. You can find people's family photos. Of course, the Gemini giant is taller than the rest of the family,
right,
but everybody gathered around him. And this is one of the reasons the GoFundMe was so popular, because everybody who has either done the actual Route 66 or been through Wilmington for any other reason, and there are lots of them, had seen the Gemini giant. I mean, he was, as you said, hard to miss. It's a 20-foot man in a green suit holding a rocket.
Standing there, right.
Sasha Ann Simon talking with the architecture sleuth Dennis Rodkin about the famous Gemini giant in Wilmington and a Route 66 icon. You can see the giant, read more about it, on our show page at the station's website. DNA testing can be expensive. One state lawmaker wants to make it free for some black residents. Analiko Chuba with the Illinois Student Newsroom reports.
The program would be the first of its kind. It would make DNA testing free to African Americans in Illinois who are descendants of slaves. State Representative Carol Ammons says she began developing the program after she discovered it would cost $700 to find out more about her ancestry.
We thought and felt that it is inappropriate for descendants of those who were enslaved in the Americas or anywhere else in the world to have to pay a commercial vendor to find out where you come from. And every people deserves to know where they come from.
Ammons introduced a House resolution that would urge support for the program. She expects the resolution could be voted on in the next few weeks, and the program could start as soon as this summer. I am Analiko Chuba, Illinois Student Newsroom.
The conversation around giving struggling families cash with no strings attached is headed to the state. Esther Yoon-Gi King has more details.
Illinois is exploring establishing a state board to look into the practice known as guaranteed income. Chicago and Cook County recently had pilot programs. Ameya Pawar is with the Economic Security Project. The nonprofit is an advocate of cash programs.
We know cash works. We know it is a potent tool to stabilize families, to reduce poverty, to improve the social determinants of health. And so scaling the conversation statewide is important to meet the moment.
Pawar says guaranteed income could fill the gaps left by traditional social safety net programs like food stamps and housing vouchers. Esther Yunji Kang, WBEZ News.
Killers of the Flower Moon was a best-selling nonfiction book about the brutal murders of Osage Indians for their wealth and land. Now it's become a blockbuster movie directed by Martin Scorsese and starring Lily Gladstone and Leonardo DiCaprio. And the community where many of the murders took place is still wrestling with how to open up about the painful past. Contributor Allison Herrera takes us to Fairfax, Oklahoma.
Dr. Carol Connor knows downtown Fairfax, population 1,100, like the back of her hand. So a few years ago, it really started catching her attention when she would see cars parked in front of the historic Tall Chief Theater.
And so I would be driving down our main street, which is mostly vacant of cars, and there would be a Volvo or a Lexus.
Carol is a little extroverted.
So I would pull up next to them and say, "What are you doing here? Did you read the book?" And they would say, "How did you know that?" Well, duh, there's no one else on the street, and you're in a Lexus from Minnesota.
This was shortly after David Grant's nonfiction book was released. Carol and her husband Joe, an Osage citizen, decided to use money from the nonprofit they run, called the Fairfax Community Foundation, to offer more information.
We need to do something. So I basically created this exhibit, giving people a background of who the Osage people were, how we got here, what led up to the murders.
Dr. Joe Connor said he wanted to tell people the why.
What was the impact of those murders on this community afterwards?
At my high school, actually had us all read the book, and that's the first time I found out about the murders and what happened to the Osage people.
Owen Hutchison is a young Osage man who works for Joe and Carol Connor and grew up in Fairfax.
I think a part of that was Osages that do still live here didn't want to talk about it. I mean, it's a scary past, and it's hard, and then the people who our non-Osages that lived here either didn't know or they were complicit at the time.
Shannon Shaw Duty is the editor of the Osage News and also grew up here. Her great aunt Liz was alive at the time and had friends and family who were murdered.
They didn't want to talk about it, and we never understood. But we do now. We understand it now. It was too painful.
When the book hit the shelves in 2017, Carol remembers getting a very frosty response when she put an item in the paper she and Joe published called the Fairfax Chief, a newspaper that's been around since the 1920s.
So small-town newspapers, no one ever unsubscribes. They die, but they don't unsubscribe. But the week that we had David Grant at the Tall Chief Theater to sign books, I had 12 people unsubscribe from the newspaper.
But a few years later, attitudes began to change. Martin Scorsese signed on to direct the movie, and that was exciting. And more importantly, his film crew actually listened to Osages about their concerns for the movie. Joe and Carol Connor wanted to take the momentum of the film and run with it. They're part of an effort to revitalize downtown Fairfax, including a historic theater built for the community after the murders.
We're standing in front of, though. That's the most
important. Oh, we're standing right in front of the Tall Chief Theater.
Saving it is a passion project for Joe Connor.
And we see this as an investment in the future of not only just Osages, but also the entire community.
Osage citizen Danette Daniels is also trying to uplift the community. She was raised here. She's opening up a museum, gift, and coffee shop in a building she bought and renovated.
I want to be part of bringing Fairfax back, revitalizing Fairfax.
She's hoping to give tours on the second floor of the building where the two doctors, the Schoen brothers, allegedly poisoned Osages.
Oh my God, look.
So this is filmed in the movie? This is filmed. They showed his staircase.
Yes. I asked Danette how she felt about offering tours to people about this terrible subject.
Well, it's history. So it's just the truth. And people need to understand the truth.
What does it feel like to own part of this history?
It feels good, especially as an Osage person. Yeah, taking it back.
Taking back history. These Fairfax citizens see the movie as an opportunity to honor the victims of the murders and move forward. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Allison Herrera.
Since Allison reported that story, Joe Connor has passed away. There is more to come on Statewide. Stay right here. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll talk about age bias in the hiring process. But first, Eureka College Media Studies professor Phil Duncan brought together his intersecting interests in environmental history, media studies, and music in Mississippi Mud, A Natural History of the Blues. Duncan presents the short documentary this weekend at the 14th Annual Blue Whiskey Independent Film Festival near Chicago. He told reporter Lauren Warnicki he's always been interested in how media and music reflect the natural world, no truer than the Mississippi Delta.
I think music is always a product of the environment it comes out of. I grew up in the Northwest in the late 90s and the early 2000s. And, you know, a lot of the music that came out of there, I think, is kind of directly related to the environment, especially if you're talking about things like grunge music coming out of a depressing gray environment. And I think there's a lot of reasons why that music came from there at that time. So when I go back and I kind of think about blues music, which is something that's been very big in my life for a very long time, it was really meaningful for me to be able to go to the place where at least the most dominant strain of blues, the Delta blues, comes from in Mississippi, and see how the environment, how the people's relationship to the environment kind of helped bring the music from the Delta to everywhere else.
I'm thinking about this kind of paradox between the natural landscape, which evolves like quicker than most places because of the river, right? And also the forced landscape with the role of agriculture and specifically cotton and tobacco in that region.
We always joke and say it's in the water as far as the talent. It's in the soil. And that very well may be true. It's the river has made it possible for life to be so abundant.
The Mississippi Delta in particular is interesting because it is, for the most part, completely human-made. Even till the Civil War, the Delta was a frontier. They still had, you know, panthers and bears and alligators. It was wild. It was all forest and swamp. And, you know, if you've ever spent time in Mississippi, you understand that it's basically a jungle. It's very hot and very humid. So that land was very much ignored until after the Civil War in a lot of ways. And then there was kind of a land grab. That land was completely changed. All the trees were cut down. So you have a lot of blues songs that are from lumber camps and things like that. All the land had to be tilled. The levees had to be built to keep the river from flooding over the banks whenever it felt like it. Because the Mississippi, if you look at an old map of it, it went all over the place and deviated many miles in any direction. So they first had to tame the river, tame the land, and then really control the population in some ways who had better opportunities elsewhere and were in some places held against their will. It was a kind of a modern reintroduction of slavery.
This region, as well as areas around the bayou in Louisiana, you know, I wonder what the immediate current picture of that looks like, and the precarity and volatility of this region as weather events and climate change increasingly push people out. But there has been some, maybe not enough, attention placed on the fact that, generationally poor families are unable to leave, and so they have to continually rebuild houses on the same land, only for those houses to be, you know, washed away in another couple of years later. So I guess wonder where that factors into how musicians that are still there in that region, you know, have chosen to stay or have been forced to stay for whatever reason, if that kind of factors into any of this at all.
Yeah, I would say the modern outlook in the Mississippi Delta is a lot different in some ways because so many people left, especially to places in the north and the west and the northeast. And also automation happened, right? So a lot of people who picked cotton in the fields, they or their descendants moved to Peoria to build the machines that would go back to the Delta to automate the process. So you needed less farm labor nowadays, right? So there's, while cotton is still a huge industry in the Mississippi Delta and corn and other, you know, agricultural products, it's not as labor intensive as it used to be. So not as many people work in that field. So in some ways, you know, the Mississippi Delta is a very poor place. I think, you know, it has a high unemployment rate and things like that, but it's still has that kind of viable spirit of where the music coming from. And over the years, you know, there's a lot of tourism that goes through because people are interested in that history, and the state's done a pretty good job of putting markers out. And, you know, if you wanted to see which musician was born here and played there, you know, they're all over the place. So I would say that the blues continues to live in Mississippi and continues to flourish. And a lot of that is due to this kind of continual interest from people to visit. In some ways, you know, as climate change happens and we see towns like Rolling Fork, which is where Muddy Waters was born, almost completely wiped out a few years ago from a tornado. It's always going to be, and it always has been that way, that when you're poor and especially Black and poor in the South, you're on the forefront of this kind of environmental issues. So when the levee would flood back in the 1920s, it was disproportionately affecting, you know, Black agricultural workers. And I think in some ways you still see that playing out.
Well, now I get late over in the evening, I feel like blowing my horn. When I woke up this morning, all I had was gone again. Late over in the evening, man, now I feel like blowing my horn. Well, now woke up this morning, all I had was gone.
That's Phil Duncan, filmmaker of Mississippi Mud, A Natural History of the Blues. He's also a media professor at Eureka College. He spoke with Lauren Warnicki. Do older individuals face bias when it comes to getting a job? Stacy Haller is the chief career advisor for ResumeBuilder.com. The online service recently surveyed 1,000 hiring managers and found age bias exists for the most senior applicants and their Gen Z counterparts. Maureen McKinney spoke with her.
Your survey showed that 4 in 10 hiring managers have an age bias against Gen Z, and one-third admit to age bias against senior candidates. So which is really worse if you're trying to get a job?
I think what's worse is what we're seeing is everybody's having a bias against somebody in this hiring process. These numbers that you just shared, when I looked underneath it, it turns out that 63% of our respondents were between the ages of 25 and 44. So it looks like that cohort group is not hiring people younger than them or older than them. And that's really interesting. And this cohort are the folks that are first getting into management. So when I read this and I'm like, okay, so now we have the first year's early folks in their management career having a bias against the Gen Z. And we know there has been bias against Gen Z because they entered the workforce with skills that were not sharpened due to remote work. And since they started remote, when they got into the workforce, we've had many surveys, and you could read a lot on the internet about why folks are not interested in hiring Gen Zers, because they don't have the skills and organizations have not been prepared on how to train them and onboard them, understanding that. And we know there's been bias against older workers always. So when you say which is worse, I think they're both pretty bad. And I don't think age should ever be a requisite in terms of a requirement for anybody getting hired.
Isn't it true that there are laws against age discrimination?
Absolutely. 100% age discrimination is illegal. And some people have brought some cases up. Many times, though, you don't even know you're being age discriminated against, or you wouldn't know. It might not be obvious. You could be sending out many resumes and not getting called. Now, you might assume at some point it's age, but it's never in a place where you could actually prove it or have a case. So it is very difficult in that regard. And as hard as that is, it's very easy for people to discriminate about age, because we have seen from some of our other surveys that if a hiring manager really wants to know how old you are, they'll resort to looking up on Facebook or looking other ways to see if they could determine. So yes, it's 100% illegal everywhere. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
The 1 in 3 said that elderly appearance is something that they'll use against a candidate?
Well, of course, my first reaction is it's amazing that people even admit to these things, honestly. And we've had other surveys just in general about how hiring managers feel about appearance, whether it might be somebody who is very overweight or very tall. And those appearance biases we know exist as well. Now, our survey that you're referring to, we did focus on senior candidates. So the bias is clear. If you're biased against older workers and you're doing a Zoom interview with someone and they appear elderly to you, or they're even showing, sometimes even not knowing the technology, or people do have biases against people with gray hair as well, they're going to judge you on your appearance. That is not only relegated to seniors, by the way, but it does happen. And yes, that's all illegal too.
I'd imagine years of job experience would flag you as being older. Why does having an address listed, why does that flag you as older?
Because people don't mail you anything anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is done by mail. And there's another very good reason. It's another reason for bias. People mm-hmm. will judge you where you live. It's totally irrelevant. Nobody's mailing you anything. Nobody needs to know where you live. So we started eliminating street addresses off of resumes over a decade ago for those very two reasons. Just like a picture is not appropriate on a resume either. It just fuels bias. And it's irrelevant as to whether or not you could be a great employee.
What does that mean for the person looking for a job?
And that really is the key. You know, for seniors, let's say, who are looking for work, and many of them, there's no retirement age anymore. There are more seniors that if they want to work, they have more opportunities, especially due to remote work. But it's important about how you go about that search, knowing that there is age discrimination out there. So that includes everything from on your resume, having an AOL address flags you as an older person. Having things like your street address on your resume, that no longer belongs there. And that also positions you as someone older. So just what's on your resume might indicate you're not current today. So it's very important on how a resume is structured. Graduation dates, no longer necessary. There's no reason that you need to have the date of your college degree or when you graduated. Just the fact that you have a degree. So those are some things that could eliminate some age bias. And then, of course, these folks need to stay up on top of the technology, show energy, show they're willing to learn, fight against what we know the biases are. And the younger generation, to fight their biases, they have to acknowledge that there's some skills that they will need going forward. Knowledge will help all the generations get through some of this bias as we kind of chip away. Because clearly, it's not helpful to anyone. And the more I see these surveys, I'm wondering who doesn't have a bias against them.
Who doesn't? Who is least likely to suffer from hiring manager's bias?
When I look at this survey and I see that the people who tend to feel this way and are carrying these biases are, let's say, the late 20s to the mid 40 year old managers, it looks to me like they're only hiring themselves then if they have biases on folks older or younger than them. But we also know within this group that there are other biases. People have race biases, sex biases. So it does make me wonder, with the proliferation of biases and then the backlash to that was building diversity within organizations and paying attention to this. And unfortunately, the news later says sometimes we're moving away from it. Everybody needs to pay attention. I really think the importance is bringing this to everyone's attention. I think it's in some ways encouraging that we're talking about it so we could pay attention to it and work to eliminate it, where for many generations it wasn't spoken about.
Career advisor Stacy Haller of ResumeBuilder.com talking about age bias in the hiring process. We're out of time for this week statewide. Thanks for being along. Join us next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Remember, you can find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at NPRIllinois.com. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.